Well, good morning. This is Per Fograng, and we have a couple guests here. Right here in the studio, we have Gerard Ungerman, who has made a movie called The Oil Factor, Behind the War on Terror. And also with us is KBOO fan Pete Anderson, who is sort of the contact person across the river in Vancouver. Now, this film is playing tonight. Tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library, and the address is 1007 East Mill Plain Boulevard in the lower conference room. And I imagine that is probably right as you go up on I-5, the fort is right there, so it can't be far from I-5.
Yeah, you hop off on Mill Plain, the Mill Plain exit, and it's about a block and a half east of the I-5 freeway.
Mm-hmm.
On your right-hand side, you can make a right on Fort Vancouver Way and a left into the parking lot, or you can go through the light and make a right into the parking lot, which is on the east side of the library. It'll be in the lower conference room.
Oh, it sounds real easy. Okay, well, let's talk with Gerard Ungerman about the movie. Welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you, Pierre. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a real treat. This movie, it sounds like it's a replay of The Great Game of 100 years ago.
Well, yes, it is. I mean, nothing really changes. It just so happened that today is the top dog of international policies, to remain polite. You know, this is Washington. It used to be Rome. It used to be London. It used to be, you know, Paris. Things change, but the game is the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what is the crux? It seems to me that the crux of the situation is that the world's oil, most of it, is located in Central Asia and the Middle East.
Well, no, definitely, especially the Middle East, that has about 70% of what's left of oil and natural gas. Central Asia doesn't have so much, and there's a big debate about exactly how much there is. There seems to be more natural gas at this point than oil in Central Asia. But it's all a position, it's all basically controlling Central Asia means controlling access to both local reserves and also the Middle East to a great degree. And we see an arm wrestling between, you know, Moscow, Washington, and Beijing for the control of this area. And that's definitely why it's so important for Washington to position troops, you know, in the area, not just in Afghanistan, but also in other places like, you know, Uzbekistan, until recently Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, so that to placate basically attempts by Moscow and Beijing to position themselves, engineers for oil and troops eventually.
Well, it seems that Russia and China have the great advantage of being right there. I mean, that's in their backyard, where the U.S. has to, send its troops several thousand miles and plop them down at some base someplace.
Absolutely. Especially the former Soviet republics used to be evidently the perceived backyard of Russia, and to a great degree, Moscow still feel that they have kind of a historical right of access to this part of the world. And as far as, you know, China, of course, China is right there. They've tried and they succeeded actually in convincing Kyrgyzstan to basically allow their engineers to come and exploit the oil and natural gas. Now, of course, the U.S. is top military dog. They have the highest capability to project forces. China at this point doesn't have such a capability to project, you know, forces. But nevertheless, the U.S. military is being strained very, very, you know, hardly in Iraq at this point. And they tried to have NATO police Afghanistan to try to basically share the burden. But the U.S. military is not in a very good, you know, position right now to be flexing muscle in Central Asia and trying to arm, you know, wrestle both Russia and China at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the U.S. went into Iraq. We were going to show the world how strong we were, and what we've shown is how weak we are. And there we are, stuck, you know. They've got, you know, it's amazing. Here, Iraq is not being rebuilt at all. But the U.S. has built this huge presence, you know, the embassy, which is like a fortress right in the middle of Baghdad, and then all these bases, which are like American towns, just plopped down in the desert, you know, surrounded by fortifications. We can build that, but we can't rebuild Iraq.
No, absolutely. And, you know, again, these ETECs are, I was myself in the military, so I know. And I always actually, we've interviewed the executive director of the project for the New American Century, Gary Schmidt, for the documentary. Actually, he's a voice of power of the government, you know, in the documentary, The Old Factor, that we show tonight. I mean, yes, this very, well, not conservative, actually, this neoconservative think tank that believes into basically projecting American military force around the world to secure all possible, what's called politely, business opportunities or commerce, you know, opportunities for U.S. corporations in the world, have been actually working on this idea of you know, confiscating not just Iraq, but pretty much all the oil-rich countries of the Middle East since, you know, at least the late 80s, early 90s. That's when they actually formulated this whole policy, this whole idea that Saddam Hussein should be removed, and that some, you know, some, what comes down to, you know, some pro-American patsy should be installed in Iraq, so that, you know, this country could be in the fold of Washington.
Well, it's interesting. Some of these neocons back in the 30s and 40s, they were lefties. They were Trotskyites. And what they've kind of done is stand Trotskyism on its head. Instead of perpetual revolution, is perpetual counter-revolution they're pushing. And that seems to be their strategy. How did you get the interview with, what's his name, Gary Schmidt?
Gary Schmidt. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, basically we, in the type of documentaries that we've been doing, and we've been making documentaries, now political documentaries, for over 10 years with my wife, Audrey Brohi, I guess it's a bit because of my interest for intelligence coming from my military years that, you know, we always want to look at the big picture of, you know, this kind of international crisis, both from a standpoint of who are the big players, what strings are being pulled, and how does it affect, you know, regular people, simple people, be them civilians on the ground or even, you know, military personnel. So we always have this dual, you know, focus. And in the, we always like to, as much as possible, to show also both sides of the equation, both, you know, positions, a position which is pro, you know, pro war, pro military intervention, pro confiscation of markets and resources, and which of course may not say it, evidently. Mm-hmm. And then it's the other side, which is usually pro human rights, pro democracy and everything. So we always try to have somebody either from the State Department or from, you know, power elite, giving their point of view. And nowadays, it's becoming more and more difficult to have access to the State Department or the Pentagon for, you know, one-on-one interview opportunities. Now, they don't want to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. They only give, you know, press conferences that are very boring and, you know, lack all kind of substance. So we had to have our, you know, our good bad guy in this documentary. So we basically, you know, we approached Mr. Gary Schmidt, who is not only the executive director of the project for the New American Century, he's also a bit, you know, their spokesman. And I guess it was at a time where they still felt confident that they could sell their point of view to the rest of the world, you know, without being laughed at, and so that's how we managed to have him.
Mm. That's interesting too. A lot of these neocons, you know, who are there for a military solution, very few of them ever served in the military themselves. You know, I mean, I think, well, Rumsfeld, now he was a Navy pilot, but all the other prominent neocons, they avoided military service like the plague. You
plus
know?
The members of their families,
mm-hmm.
not to mention the president.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and here they are. I don't know. That's one of the things that really gets me going is these armchair warriors, you know. I mean, I've been in the Army, too. I was very lucky between wars, but, boy, it's these guys sit in their offices and their grand dreams of conquest, you know, as long as somebody else, it's like capitalism, you know, you play with somebody else's money in the military as you play with other people's lives. You know?
Absolutely. Probably the only character who I can think was actively in the military and was actually known to be, you know, to be crazy and to be a butcher. That was this fine Richard Armitage.
Well, that's right. Yeah, tell us a little bit about him. I mean, a lot of people don't know enough about Richard Armitage.
Well, Richard Armitage was actually, I mean, again, and I'm not a specialist on Mr. Richard Armitage. I've read a couple of things, but he seemed to have been playing a key role in covert operations in Cambodia, mm-hmm. at the time of the Vietnam War, and was somebody who was known to be very brutal, very cruel, somebody who enjoyed actually, you know, killing
physically
people.
Physically, directly, yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. He was a man on the ground.
He was a big guy, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, he was mm-hmm. a killer, you know, mm-hmm. and I guess he, by being involved in this covert operation as a hands-on, you know, killer, he made some good buddies, you know, that eventually led him to have key positions in various governments, in particular the government of Ronald Reagan. Then he landed again some positions under, you know, George Bush. I mean, the real, you know, George Bush, the father. And then again he became under George Bush Jr. I think he was assistant Secretary of State, who was kind of there to monitor what John Colin Powell was doing. So he seems to be always a shadowy figure, mm-hmm. who's basically, you know, a henchman for neocons.
But Armitage, wasn't he sort of protege of Colin Powell? Don't they have a very close relationship?
Again, I wouldn't go there. I mm-hmm. don't know enough.
Oh, okay. But Armitage, you know, you hear his name, and he sort of, they think of him as being part of the so-called realist school, you know, not a crazy, but he is kind of nutty, isn't he?
Well, he seems to be, and he's, you know, definitely mm-hmm. his past and the kind of friends that he makes, you know, mm-hmm. says a lot about who the individual is.
So who are some of the other people in the film?
Well, we've interviewed, you know, a fairly wide array of people. We always try to cover, as I said, you know, a whole spectrum of things and people. We've interviewed, people from the human rights, you know, background. We've interviewed people from Amnesty International, from Human Rights Watch, you know, for instance. Now we've interviewed, you know, soldiers on the ground. We've interviewed a spokesman, a military spokesman for the U.S. forces in Afghanistan. We've interviewed, you know, simple people on the street, you know, both in Iraq and Afghanistan when we spent 3 months, you know, there, 2 years ago when it was still safe to travel in Iraq. Who else did we interview? We've interviewed, Noam Chomsky, for instance. We had a very interesting interview from a magazine which is not usually looked at by, you know, traditional American left, and I think it's wrong because they have some very good analysis in this, but Jane's Intelligence, which mm-hmm. is a British magazine, but tend to have a more conservative viewpoint on many things, but nevertheless, they have some good analysis about military matters and international policy, you know, matters, and I think it's good to pay attention to what these guys have to say, because often they are right on, and that doesn't mean that they support at all. In this case, they do not support at all the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. So, well, the way thing, I don't know, it's almost like we're in an end game now with Iraq. It's, do you think it's possible that the U.S. will be able to stay in Iraq very long, or will they be forced to leave?
I mean, it's a very difficult thing to say. I mean, clearly the situation is an absolute quagmire, a mm-hmm. bloody quagmire, and there's no end in sight. It was absolutely crazy to go there. I mean, the only way, you know, the U.S. military could stay there forever would be basically to nuke the entire country, kill everybody, and make it, you know, a flat desert with not a soul in sight. And then they might be able to stay there, you know, forever, which evidently is not going to happen. So what will happen, you know, it's very difficult to tell. There was a lot of investment made from the part of neocons and other American, you know, corporations, oil and weapon-making companies in particular. So the interest to stay in Iraq is huge. And I think they are clearly trying at this point to do, to replicate a bit what the British did in 1929 when they split the Kuwait from Iraq to create at this time in the 20s and 30s, Kuwait was a province of Iraq and had the only known oil reserves of Iraq. So the British thought that it would be easier to control that part of the country by splitting it from the rest of Iraq. That's what they did. They installed, you know, a bogus monarchy over there that didn't exist, you know, before. And I think there's this perception that, you know, which is again universal. Divide and conquer. It's easier to control a smaller geographic entity than a big country. And I think there's a, you know, what we've observed at this point is a lot of acts of anonymous terrorism, which clearly, you know, seem to be actually psychological warfare to try basically to pit Shia against Sunnis, against Kurds, eventually to split the country into three entities, so that it would be easier in this case to, you know, have friends in the north with the Kurds that have oil around Mosul in particular, then somehow try to, you know, make friends, which is absolutely idiotic, you know, with Shias in the south, because of course Tehran is a big influence of their Iraqi Shias. So there's no making friends with Shias, you know, from Washington. The idea is absolutely, you know, ludicrous. And then just let the Sunni center, you know, rot by itself. You know, they have no oil, and you know, the country is sinking into abysmal violence, you know, at this point. Whether or not they will succeed in breaking the country in three, you know, is to be seen. But clearly, I think that kind of chaos is unmanageable, not even to mention absolutely immoral.
Well, this is something I suspected, that the U.S. strategy has been to divide up Iraq and, you know, Seymour Hersh talks about, you know, these special forces units kind of operating all over the place, and that and the British apparently had troops going into Iran from their base in southern Iraq, and also when some British soldiers were caught by in a car filled with explosives, and they're dressed as Arabs, you see.
This was an extremely important, you know, thing, actually, because, you know, there's a lot of talk in Iraq at this point, which is not, of course, being represented at all in Western media. You know, many Iraqis, you know, whether they're Kurds, Sunnis, or Shia, have a lot of doubts about who's carrying these attacks. You know, in particular, when you see, you know, a big explosion destroying a mosque.
Samarra there?
Yes, yes, for instance. I mean, would Sunni, you know, would good Sunni Muslim destroy a Shia mosque or vice versa? Very unlikely. Very unlikely. And so people are talking a lot about, you know, who may be carrying these attacks, who may be actually trying to pit against Shias against Sunnis in particular, and vice versa. And there was this incident that was, you know, that seemed to bring a lot of validity to this argument that this is all psychological, you know, warfare, when these two British special forces were arrested by Iraqi police dressed up as Arabs with, you know, weapons and explosives in their, you know, civilian car. And then, you know, they were arrested, and the British forces sent tanks to basically destroy the jail.
Yes, right.
You know, they got them out of there, and it was the end of the story. But it was it was widely reported, you know, by the BBC, widely reported by Al Jazeera and other Arab-speaking networks in the Middle East, as being evidence that there was full play, definitely.
From the West. Then when the mosque in Samarra was blown up, apparently it took, whoever blew it up, it took them, I think, 12 hours, you know, to set up all the explosives and everything. I mean, they did a real professional job. They just brought it down, you see. And so they had to be in there for a long time. And they had the guards tied up or something like that. It just seems like some kind of a special forces operation.
No, it seems to be likely, yeah.
Another thing you hear about is, well, I talk about splitting up Iraq. I mean, maybe the plan is to create like another Kuwait in southern Iraq, you know, because all the oil is located in that one, even in Saudi Arabia. And there's some guy talking to the Pentagon a few years ago about basically seizing the Saudi oil fields. So that if that succeeds, you'd have southern Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia controlled by, you know, by the military. I don't know how long they could control it, though, but that seems to be one of their, you know, possibilities.
Well, again, it's one of the possibilities that seems to make some sense when you're, you know, some politician of far away, sitting in a comfortable armchair and looking at a map on the wall. And so, you know, you just, you know, take your pen and make some marks on the map. Hey, that makes good sense here. But then, you know, it's a whole different board game when you're on the ground.
That's right. That's right. Well, and then Iran, their on-again, off-again oil bores apparently is going to open this next week, unless they decide not to again. But that's the last I heard.
Yes, I mean, I've heard in particular that, Norway also is talking about opening a bourse in euros. There is, you know, evidently that the dollar is losing ground, you know, very quickly at this point, and everybody is kind of, you know, guessing when the dollar will collapse and everything. And the euro seems to be a strong currency at this point. And, you know, there's been probably a lot of debate in many European capitals that tend to be very shy, to be polite, about, you know, trying to displease in Washington. And I think there's a lot of debate about should we go long? Should we buy our oil in euros? Should we please in Washington and still, you know, use dollars? I think there's been a lot of probably back and forth, you know, discussions on these issues. And Iran maybe felt that it was more important to try to, for them, you know, to push their ability to refine uranium for, you know, be it for power or for weapons in the end. You know, we don't know. But anyway, I think this was one of their priorities. And I think now Iran sees with the erosion of the dollar that they have a fairly strong hand, you know, here, and that maybe it is now worth it for them to try to defy Washington even further by opening this bourse in euros.
Well, as far as Europe goes, maybe their plan A is to kind of go along with Washington, but they must have a plan B, you know. And plan B would be, they've got the euros and just start buying their oil. They're buying their gas directly from Russia, even though they don't like it very much. They kind of raise objections, you know, accuse Russia of strong-arming them and stuff. But Russia's in the position they can shut off the gas if they want. And I just read the other day that Poland is really ticked off because Russia and Germany are talking about a direct gas pipeline from Russia to Germany under the Baltic Sea. We don't even have to go through Poland.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. You know, we are going to, besides, of course, I mean, yes, there is a lot of, in international policies, there's a lot of talks and opinions about whether, you know, Europe should side with Russia, which is also, you know, Europe evidently, or should, you know, side with Washington. So there's a bit of contention, and there's some, you know, different think tanks and politician opinions about this, you know, Europe. It's a big debate. But nevertheless, I think as we, you know, see on the one hand, Washington starting to become more and more of, and I would like to say Washington as opposed to the U.S., you know, even though I don't mean to insult, you know, residents of Washington, you know, city. But
the warlords.
Yeah,
exactly. Washington warlords.
Absolutely. I mean, it's clear that, you know, things are getting out of control. You know, the government in Washington is turning, you know, to be an extremely rogue, you know, government, and it scares people around the world. And it goes a long way at discrediting completely, unfortunately, you know, American foreign policies. So they will definitely eventually be, you know, an erosion of the image of America and the world because of this regime. And on top of it, evidently, we will come soon to a point where all the different players in the world economy will start being desperate to, you know, maximize whatever they can of their access to oil, which at this point is absolutely necessary for all our economies. And we're going to see decisions being made that will basically reflect a sentiment of we have to survive at all costs. We have to maintain our economies a bit longer.
Well, it's the International Energy Agency apparently has a treaty that they signed with all the major countries in the world that if there is an oil emergency, that there will be quotas imposed, kind of a rationing. And it's possible, you know, even when peak oil occurs, which may be now, next year, whenever, there's still a lot of oil left in the ground. It's just not the cheap oil. And that if the countries got together and they decided to, you know, ration it out for what's necessary, you know, that that would give the world time to adjust and create alternative energies.
No, it would, you know, definitely. I think the intelligent response to this crisis is basically to collaborate and find no global solutions. But now when we have, you know, when we have such people as, you know, Dick Cheney running the show here, mm-hmm. who says very proudly that, you know, the American way of life is not negotiable, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. That mean that, you know, this cowboy mentality is, I'm sorry, I have the gun, you know, I like your land, give it to me. I like your oil, give it to me. You know, God gave me a bigger gun, so, you know, you do what I say or I kill you. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a mentality.
Well, it's like what Richard Heinberg called the last man standing strategy. But then what are you standing on? You're standing on a hill that's collapsing underneath your feet. So it's just, it's self-defeating.
It's madness.
It is. It is. And here we are. Well, madness. What do families do when somebody goes crazy? They do what they call an intervention. And I wonder if some of the people who really run things in this country, you know, you keep hearing that they are deciding that George Bush is really screwing things up for the empire. Do you think they will intervene in one way or another? I wonder if that's a possibility.
Well, I know for a fact that there's a lot of discussion from inside the Pentagon. You know, that would be extremely, extremely wrong to think that everybody at the Pentagon or everybody at the State Department or everybody, you know, in the FBI or the CIA thinks the same. There's a lot of contention, you know. These organizations are not gangs. I mean, they're not populated only by criminals. They are being used by criminals, you know, that's for sure. But there's a lot of talks in the Pentagon in particular about this whole idea of using these, you know, politely called bunker busters, which are basically, you know, nuclear weapons. And there's a lot of people who don't agree to this, know perfectly well where this all will lead us. And what we can hope is that some rational, high-ranking generals in the Pentagon will just say, no, this is crazy. If we follow these goons who have, for the most part, no military experience and should have no say in military matters, maybe we should, you know, we hope that these guys will eventually say we should stop these guys before it's too late.
Well, that seems to be what happened when this Congressman John Murtha spoke out last year that shocked everybody because he'd always been a very close to the military. Well, he was speaking for the military. He was speaking for these generals. I guess we're near the end of our time. We're talking with Gerard Ungerman, who has produced a film called The Oil Factor, Behind the War on Terror. And this film is playing tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library, and that's easy to get to. You just drive up I-5 into Vancouver and take the Mill Plain exit, and then you're kind of right there.
It's the second exit off of 5. Make a right, head east about a block and a half, and you'll see Fort Vancouver Library on your right-hand side. And if anyone mm-hmm. has any questions,
sure,
give
your phone.
My phone number, Pete Anderson, 360 area code, 260-8937. Or if you want to email me, it's Pete, P-E-T-E, .a@comcast.net.
And if you want also to see information about the documentary, or again, you know, check for the address, you can also visit our website at www.theoilfactor.com.
TheOilFactor.com. Is this movie going to be showing elsewhere too after this?
Well, actually, we've been touring all of last year, you know, across the country, showing it. I don't know. I don't have anything planned at this point. We have a tour coming up in Canada. Mm-hmm. At this point, I don't have a set date yet. I know we're going to show on the 17th on the Oregon coast, I believe in Newport.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we're going to have to end it now. Thank you very much for being with us, and stay tuned for Democracy Now!
Thank you.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
And you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. The time is about a half a minute after 11. Time for Democracy Now!
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
My father has been in prison for the past 3.5 years, and on Monday a judge sentenced him to another 1.5 years. And he gave them the maximum sentence, even though a jury found him not guilty of most of the counts against him back in December, and they were hung on the rest of the charges.
Two daughters speak about the plight of their fathers. Leila Al-Aryan is the daughter of Palestinian professor and activist Sami Al-Aryan. Wiam Hamouda is the daughter of Samia Hamouda, who also remains in jail despite being acquitted of all charges. Then Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert addresses thousands of journalists and President Bush at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An Armenian passenger plane has crashed off Russia's Black Sea coast, killing all 113 people on board. Armenian airline officials say they suspect the crash was due to bad weather. On Capitol Hill here in the United States, Republicans have dropped a proposal to provide consumers with $100 rebates to offset rising gas costs. The idea was floated last week amidst a growing public outcry over record gas prices. The abandonment of the rebate plan comes just one day after Republicans said they would also drop a tax proposal opposed by the oil industry and other business leaders. Republican House Speaker Dennis Hastert said Republicans would focus their efforts on opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Hastert made the announcement after meeting with ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson. Speaking in Washington, New York Senator Chuck Schumer criticized the Republicans' ties to the oil industry.
The last person in the world you'd want to make oil policy in America is George Bush, because George Bush believes in his bones that what's good for ExxonMobil is good for America. That's how he was raised. That's how he was brought up. He can't do anything against. And that's why the policies that he and his Republican leadership have come up with are sort of a joke.
New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer. In Iraq, 15 people were killed, 13 wounded earlier today when a suicide bomber attacked a recruitment line outside a Fallujah police station. Meanwhile, police in Baghdad said they've found the bodies of at least 14 men who've been tied up and shot dead. According to Reuters, Baghdad's main morgue received at least 65 bodies on Monday and Tuesday. Meanwhile, an unidentified Iraqi ambulance worker was killed Tuesday when he was shot by a group of American security contractors. The worker's colleague, Abu Ali, described the attack.
We were driving here to deliver a case to the hospital when a bomb went off close to a passing convoy of Americans. The Americans opened fire on him, shooting him in the heart. Their sniper shot him twice and one of them in his heart. What is his crime? We are ambulance drivers who help people during attacks. What have we done wrong?
That was Abu Ali, the colleague of an unidentified Iraqi ambulance worker shot dead Tuesday by U.S. security contractors. In other Iraq news, two German engineers were freed Tuesday after nearly 16 weeks in captivity. The men were abducted in late January from an oil refinery north of Baghdad. In Italy, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has abandoned his bid to cling to power following his loss in last month's national elections. Berlusconi submitted his resignation Tuesday. Romano Prodi, leader of the winning center-left coalition, is expected to be named prime minister in the coming weeks. In Mexico, President Vicente Fox is expected to sign into law a measure that decriminalizes the possession of small amounts of drugs, including marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. The measure was approved by the Mexican Senate Friday over the strong objection of U.S. officials. Back in the United States, the release of thousands of declassified military documents is raising new questions about the role of senior Army commanders at the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal. According to the ACLU, the documents show Army Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the former top U.S. military commander in Iraq, urged his troops to, quote, go to the outer limits to extract information from prisoners. Previously released documents have linked Sanchez to the use of Army dogs during interrogations. The Bush administration is coming under criticism from consumer and health advocates over a new Federal Trade Commission and Health and Human Services report that advocates say is too lax on food marketing and childhood obesity. Gary Ruskin, executive director of Commercial Alert, said, quote, the junk food industry will be thrilled that the government recommends no federal restrictions on junk food marketing to children, despite the continued worsening of the childhood obesity epidemic. The report shows once again that the Bush administration cares more about the profits of the food industry than the health of our children, he said. Meanwhile, the foundation run by former President Bill Clinton has announced a deal with the country's major beverage companies to end the sale of soft drinks in public schools. Under the agreement, companies including Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and Cadbury Schweppes have agreed to sell only low or non-fattening drinks to elementary and middle schools. Diet sodas will be sold only in high schools. An estimated 35 million students will be affected by the deal. And finally, in Boston, a free speech controversy has erupted at Brandeis University over the removal of an exhibition featuring the paintings of Palestinian youths. The exhibit's 17 paintings depicted the young artist's perspectives on life under Israeli military occupation. But just 4 days into a two-week run, the exhibit was removed by Brandeis officials after several complaints from students. A university spokesperson said the school would consider remounting the paintings if they were to appear alongside paintings showing an Israeli perspective. The exhibition was curated by an Israeli Jewish student who said she wanted to showcase a Palestinian perspective on campus. The student, Lior Halperin, said, quote, this was an opportunity to bring to Brandeis the Palestinian voice that is not spoken or heard through an Israeli or an American Jew, but directly delivered from Palestinians. Obviously, that was just too much for Brandeis, she said. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.